This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We have a special program today. This is a firsthand look at the transformation of a democracy into an autocracy. You're going to hear the story of a man who was right there on the front lines reporting on how the president of Turkey was trampling on the rule of law and amassing power to himself until, on orders from the government, he was fired and forced to leave the country. His name is Abdulhamit Balici. And last week, he came to Oklahoma City, sponsored by the Turkish Raindrop House, a humanitarian organization here. After speaking for an hour in the city, he visited our offices in Edmond, our radio studio, and he gave us an hour-long personal interview. I hope you'll stick around and hear the interview later on in the program. We're going to start, though, by hearing this man's remarkable story, and it really will help you understand better what is happening in this crucial nation. Imagine that tomorrow the United States government begins shutting down newspapers. It begins manipulating, hassling, and even raiding media outlets that it considers insufficiently supportive. Imagine government agents jailing dozens and dozens of journalists and editors for dissent. Imagine the editor-in-chief of the New York Times fleeing the country to escape prison. This very scenario took place just 2 years ago in one of the world's most populous and powerful nations, Turkey. Abdulhamit Balici was editor-in-chief of the nation's largest daily newspaper, Zaman, and chief executive officer of its English-language version, Today's Zaman. But on Friday, March 4th, 2016, police raided the paper's offices in Istanbul.
Turkish police have bombarded hundreds of protesters with tear gas and rubber bullets in an attempt to disperse crowds outside the Zaman newspaper offices in Istanbul. The country's top-selling newspaper reopened on Saturday following a state takeover and police raid, but the staff has experienced a shake-up with reports of an editor-in-chief and a columnist being sacked. A top editor at Zaman's sister publication, Today's Zaman, labelled it a dark day for Turkish democracy and said most media in the country were not providing full coverage of the takeover through fear of experiencing the same fate.
A court ruling put the paper under state control. Balici was fired. The next day, some 500 Zaman supporters gathered in front of the paper's offices. Police repelled them with water cannon and tear gas. Zaman's website was replaced by a message that the site was being updated to provide, quote, unbiased coverage. 2 days later, Zaman was back online, with all its previous articles rendered inaccessible. On newsstands, a new edition of Zaman appeared. The cover featured a smiling Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The pages were full of articles supporting the Turkish president and his government. But they didn't even mention the fact that the government had just forcibly taken over the paper.
They made the newspaper, they changed the newspaper from a critical voice to a mouthpiece, a propaganda machine.
Government pressure against Balici had been increasing for about 3 years prior to the takeover. After the takeover, his life quickly became unbearable. The government monitored his calls, he was followed, he received threatening phone calls and emails. The government had started to revoke the passports of people like him who criticized the regime, so he wasn't even sure he could leave the country. After 3 weeks of being spied on and threatened, Balici went to the airport at 3 a.m. and bought a one-way ticket to Europe.
Luckily, there was no restriction or the police was sleeping.
Since that day, he has lived in exile from his own country. Balici was able to use similar cautious steps to extract his family from their home, but 2 years later, at least 50 of his colleagues at Zaman remain in prison in Turkey, and President Erdogan is seeking lifetime sentences for these journalists and prominent intellectuals. His regime now has more journalists in prison than any other country in the world. It has shut down more than 200 newspapers, television stations, and news websites. Out of 180 nations on the Reporters Without Borders World Press Freedom Index, Turkey ranks 157th. Balici warns that his country, which until very recently he considered a model of an open, free Islamic democracy, a bridge between the West and the Muslim world, has now become a model of how you can lose your democracy in just 5 years. This transformation in Turkey is not a rare fluke. It is part of a trend that is affecting other major nations. For nearly two centuries, democratic free societies led by the British Empire and the United States have flourished. But modern, sophisticated, wealthy, and well-armed nations are now reverting to authoritarianism. In Asia, Vladimir Putin is dominating Russia. Xi Jinping is dominating China. Shinzo Abe is reviving militarism and nationalism in Japan. Rodrigo Duterte is bluntly, unapologetically, and vulgarly scorning the rule of law in the Philippines. In Europe, record numbers of voters are electing nationalists. Viktor Orban in Hungary. Andrej Babiš, Sebastian Kurz in Austria. In the Middle East, the flash of optimism during the Arab Spring is over, and the region has emerged even less democratic and free, ruled by autocrats, riven by tribalism and violent turf wars. By several measures looked at globally, the power of governments and individual leaders is growing, and the freedoms of people are eroding. People are recognizing that the world is getting more aggressive and more dangerous. They're looking for security and protection, and strong men are promising to provide it. In Turkey, that man is Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Neye dayalıdır bilmiyorum. Dün Dışişleri Bakanımızla yaptıkları görüşmeler daha farklıydı.
The former mayor of Istanbul, briefly jailed for inciting violence, became prime minister in 2003. He shifted to president in 2014. During the decade and a half he has been in national power, he has significantly boosted Turkey's economy, strengthened its military, and increased its international power. In the early years of his reign, he mostly upheld the tenets of democratic representation and free and open society, in notable contrast to many other Muslim leaders. Many outsiders considered Turkey's success under Erdogan a model of successful Muslim democracy. More recently, however, Erdogan's tone has changed. He has aggressively transformed Turkish society from its once revered secular state into a nation dominated by Islam. That has meant that the independent media and the men who thrived in it, like Abdulhamit Balici, had to go. What happened in Turkey was a textbook example of how authoritarianism chokes out freedom. The newspaper Zaman had been founded in 1986 based on journalistic principles of unbiased truth-telling. It served as an important bridge between disparate sectors of a complex society that began adopting Western democracy only recently. Among the 99% Muslim population, Zaman promoted a progressive, egalitarian version of Islam, open to interfaith dialogue, and at ease with science and democracy. A lot of Turks valued that kind of journalism. With a circulation of 650,000 and a pioneering website, Zaman was the most popular, most successful newspaper in the country. But those same principles are what threatened the Erdogan government. Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, known as AKP, gradually restricted freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the right to free assembly. It got even more aggressive after it won a convincing election victory in 2011. Then the trend accelerated further in 2013 with two pivotal events. In May that year, a group of protesters staged a peaceful sit-in opposing a government plan to replace a park in Istanbul with a shopping mall. The police responded brutally. Many Turks were shocked. A wave of demonstrations rolled across the country, an estimated 3.5 million people in a country of 80 million. Erdogan forcibly put down the protests with tear gas and water cannons. In the process, 8,000 people were injured, 3,000 were arrested, and 11 were killed. Erdogan went even further, ordering the media not to report on the protests. Journalists who covered them anyway were fired on orders from the government and even from Erdogan himself. Then in December of that same year, 2013, a police investigation exposed a corrupt scheme being carried out by dozens of members of Erdogan's party and their families. The scheme involved bribery, fraud, laundering money, smuggling gold. The scandal severely tarnished Erdogan's image as a clean politician. He responded to these revelations not by reforming his government, but by tightening his grip on power. He purged the police force, strengthened his influence over the judiciary, and further subjugated the media to his control. He began referring to his critics as terrorists. Life for Abdulhamid Balici and his media colleagues got much tougher after that. When Zaman reported on the government corruption and authoritarianism, we started to get threats and we felt the heat, Balici says. Authorities began canceling their press credentials so they could no longer cover press conferences and other government events. Inspectors began visiting their offices and hunting for obscure violations. Businesses were ordered to stop buying advertisements in the paper. The judiciary, now controlled by Erdogan, allowed thousands of lawsuits against the paper's editors and reporters. Despite the pressure, Zaman continued to report on what was happening until Erdogan deployed what Balici calls the nuclear option. Decree number 668 was issued. The paper was seized by government agents. Employees lost access to internal servers and previously published articles. Its last independent issue would be the all-black cover with the quote from the Constitution of Turkey and the headline, "The Constitution is suspended." This was a major move for Erdogan's autocratic domination of his country. The next summer is when the blood started flowing. On July 15, 2016, a faction within the Turkish armed forces attempted to seize several key sites in the capital and elsewhere. Turks highly respect their military, and since 1960, military leaders have overthrown four duly elected governments for being too religious in order to protect Turkey's status as a secular country. For a moment, it looked like time might finally be up for President Erdogan's regime. But within hours, the effort collapsed. Forces loyal to the president violently repelled the anti-regime soldiers. In the conflict, more than 2,100 people were injured and more than 300 were killed. The coup attempt became what Balici calls a caricature of a coup. President Erdogan's first public statement about the coup was telling. He called it a gift from God, and that is how he treated it. He seized the opportunity to eliminate the last remaining opposition to his rule, arresting and sacking people by the tens of thousands. Critics have compared it to the Reichstag fire that Adolf Hitler used as a pretense to purge his enemies and crush civil liberties within Germany. The results of the coup were so beneficial for Erdogan that many believe he may have allowed or even staged the coup himself. Whether or not that is true, Erdogan certainly emerged a far stronger strongman. Life in Turkey has changed dramatically in the time since. A group of journalists have compiled stories and statistics about Turkish human rights abuses on a website called TurkeyPurge.com. They say that since July 15, 2016, 189 media outlets have been shut down. 319 journalists have been arrested. Over 3,000 schools, dormitories, and universities have been shut down. 4,463 judges and prosecutors have been dismissed. 5,822 academics have lost their jobs, along with 146,000 other state officials and others. 77,524 have been arrested, and 136,995 people have been detained, accused of having connections to an enemy of Erdogan, who is exiled and lives in Pennsylvania. Thus, Erdogan gained absolute control over the judiciary and the military, and virtual control over academia and the press. The state of emergency he declared after the coup remains in effect to this day. With all his opposition out of the way, Erdogan felt strong enough to start changing the Turkish constitution. An apparently growing majority of Turks want their nation to become more openly Islamic, and in Erdogan, they've found a champion for their cause. In a nationwide referendum on April 16, 2017, whose result was tainted by fraud, they narrowly voted to pass 18 constitutional amendments that can transform the nation from a parliamentary democracy into a presidential republic, an executive presidency. And Erdogan can remain in power for at least another decade in a nation that is increasingly beholden to him. Some observers called it the death of Turkish democracy. Last month, Erdogan decided to move elections that were scheduled for November 2019 up to next month. A victory will cement the sweeping executive powers that were approved in last year's referendum. Meanwhile, the president had a lavish $615 million palace constructed for himself, with over 1,000 rooms, taking up 2 million square feet, and aimed at recalling the glory of the Ottoman Empire. These moves bring to mind the words of an ancient prophecy that applies to the modern Turks in the biblical book of Obadiah. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you that dwell in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that says in his heart, "Who shall bring me down to the ground?" As dramatic as Turkey's descent into authoritarianism has been, the nation has faced little pushback from the West. America and European nations have a complicated relationship with Turkey. It is a complex geopolitical puzzle. Turkey sits at the crossroads of a developing clash of civilizations. It is anchored to the Middle East as a member of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, yet it's welded to the West as a pillar member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and for decades it's been seeking membership in the European Union. For all its contradictions, Turkey is proving itself to be an extremely significant global player. It is the largest Muslim economy and the largest in the region. Turkey is a member of the G20, a gathering of the world's 20 largest economies. Turkey also has an enormous military, the most powerful in the Middle East, and ranked by global firepower as the ninth most powerful in the world. It is NATO's second largest armed force after the U.S., with over 1 million uniformed personnel. Turkey is also a vital energy hub, linking Europe, the Middle East, and Central Asia. It's one of the most geographically strategic countries in the world, a literal bridge between continents. On its west, Turkey borders Greece and Bulgaria, EU nations. On its south, Syria, Iraq, and Iran, Middle Eastern Muslim states. And on its east, Armenia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan, former Soviet republics. It connects to the Mediterranean, Black, and Aegean Seas. It compasses the vital Bosporus and Dardanelles sea gates, linking Central Asia to the Mediterranean. And in a world increasingly driven by energy politics, its unique location translates into valuable energy transit routes for many nations. It's also made itself a valuable holding pen for Middle Eastern migrants making their way toward Europe. Turkey is by far the biggest host of Syrian refugees, of which it holds some 3.8 million. Germany has made numerous concessions to Turkey in exchange for promises to keep these refugees from flooding into the continent. Western nations rely on Turkey's cooperation in many ways, and to preserve ties, they've shown themselves willing to ignore the country's descent into tyranny. Occasionally, European leaders will express frustration over President Erdogan's behavior, but their actions have been soft. October last year, German Chancellor Angela Merkel called the human rights situation in Turkey absolutely unsatisfactory, but she said she wants to avoid a showdown and not break bridges with the Turks. A year ago, President Erdogan visited President Trump in Washington. While he was at the Turkish ambassador's residence, a small group of protesters appeared outside carrying flags of a Kurdish opposition party. Shockingly, Erdogan's bodyguards went out and assaulted these protesters. The District of Columbia police couldn't stop these well-dressed Turkish thugs from bloodying these Kurds who were exercising their free speech rights on American soil. This is how dissidents are handled in Turkey, and apparently these men forgot they were guests in America. Yet they faced no consequences. Many of Erdogan's critics are frustrated by these nations failing to hold him accountable. But this is the nature of international politics, and Erdogan knows how to play the game. He's using all his bargaining chips successfully, exercising his leverage, and taking advantage of other nations' opportunism, weakness, and lack of principle. And meanwhile, this powerful nation at the crossroads of East and West is being poisoned and increasingly consumed by anti-American, anti-Israel, Islamic fundamentalism. It's a stark picture of the world's descent into an age described in biblical prophecy as the times of the Gentiles. Abdulhamid Balici considers himself fortunate to have escaped from what he calls the open prison of his home country. Never think what occurs in remote corners of the world don't relate to you, he says.
Because it's so dramatic, you know, you are the editor-in-chief of the largest newspaper and then becoming a poor guy having nothing. I mean, you are losing your house, your assets, your career, everything is destroyed. It's like a death, you know? And then you start to start everything from zero. So these are all struggle. But meanwhile, I try to see myself in a comparative terms with my friends who are not as lucky, who are not as fortunate as me, in the sense that they are still in jail. And even they are not able to find lawyers, and they are facing lifetime sentences. So compared to that, I feel myself very lucky. And of course, from the other dimension, I try to understand that this is not the first time on earth a person is facing persecution because of his ideals or principles or honor.
Now living in America, when Balici isn't speaking and trying to raise awareness of what's happening in Turkey or searching for a job in media or academia, the former editor-in-chief of Zaman works as an Uber driver. I'm very sad to tell all those things about my beautiful country, he says. I'm taking a huge risk by speaking out. but I must do that. So I have here in the studio Abdulhamid Balighi. It's good to have you here, sir.
It's my pleasure.
So let's talk about the snap elections that Erdogan just called for very soon. I guess these were scheduled for
2019.
Later in the year, a year and a half away.
Yes.
And he said, let's push these up. Why do you suppose he did that? And I'm assuming this is going to go through. I don't think there are too many people who are looking at this and saying, you know, well, we don't quite know what the outcome of these elections are going to be. How big of a change does this represent for Turkey?
So I don't know why he needed that, indeed, because he could produce any election result, because he controls the judiciary. Judiciary controls the elections in Turkey. So he controls the judiciary, he controls the media. So I don't know why he was in a hurry. You know, you cannot manipulate elections to a big degree. You know, maybe you can manipulate 5%, but you cannot manipulate it 20%. It could be very clear for many people if you do that. And he took other steps. You know, he collaborated with one of the opposition parties, which was very main, one of the main rivals of him. So he co-opted this opposition party against some of the people from that party's internal struggle. You know, he sided with the leadership by using the judiciary, his influence in judiciary. So he stopped dynamics of change within that party. So now, indeed, he got the support of that party, which is represented by maybe 15% of Turkish society. But together with this party and his party, is not able to make 50%, which shows the decline, the amount of decline in his support. You know, one of the candidates in the opposition says that if I come, I would cancel the last referendum's system. You know, I would turn Turkey back to parliamentary system, which I think that should be done. You know, Turkish experience is very much in line with the parliamentary democracy. So executive presidency would be producing dictators in our culture, because we don't have a strong culture of democracy. So Turkey should go back to democracy, and it should start revive negotiations with European Union membership, and then should be a reliable partner in NATO, and should be strengthening its democracy, and should solve its differences internally with the Kurds, with others.
Well, how much would you view this as, say, a problem that's a result of one man taking these powers to himself and steering the country in this direction versus something that may be more systemic? You've described it as like half of the population of the country is really supportive of Erdogan, and then you have another half that is against what he's doing, and they're kind of divided among themselves.
Yeah.
If you eliminate Erdogan, does that solve the problem?
I'm not sure. One person dictates a lot of things for a couple of years. And we learned that when he acts in a positive manner, he can contribute a lot to the society, and he did. You know, in terms of economy, democracy, a lot of international perspective of Turkey. But now he is so powerful, and he's controlling everything. You know, the economy needs to be fixed. Education is in a terrible situation now. Media is in, I mean, you know, as I said, more than 200 media outlets has been shut down. So the media atmosphere needs to be fixed in a dramatic way. There are lots of problems to be solved other than Erdogan being the one man. Mm-hmm. But when he stays there as one man, all those problems will get worse. I mean, I don't know if he goes away, all those problems will be solved. We can't say that. But when he stays there, I mean, he is the source of a lot of problems.
So let's just widen the scope and talk about some of the geopolitical implications of what's happened in Turkey. If you look at Turkey's a hugely important nation within NATO. The alliance with the United States and with European nations. Right now, you're not hearing a whole lot of criticism from these nations against what is happening in Turkey, in spite of what seems like just openly violating democratic norms and human rights. Things that you would expect these countries would be much more outspoken about. But Turkey does possess a couple of pretty strong levers. In your view, how much leverage should they be trying to exercise in bringing him more in line and trying to prevent him from making the kinds of abuses of power that you see?
You know, democracy and human rights is not many times an issue of international politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, international powers and actors act depending on their interest. So this is the rule of the game.
Right.
So human rights and democracy are important, but not that important to act. So when there is a clash between the core interest and human rights, many countries prefer their interest.
Right.
This is the fact of life, you know, we should accept. So Turkey's democratization problem should be solved within. So this is the priority. You know, Turks themselves or Kurds, whatever, they should be able to solve their problems. So Turkey is part and parcel of all democratic world. So it's part of NATO, part of European Council, part of European Union, part of many things. So if this is a NATO country, can it have the freedom to destroy its media, to jail the MPs,
mm-hmm.
jail judges, and then still come to the NATO summits and the European capitals and to the White House or the German or whatever, the palaces? So this is bizarre, you know? And my point or my take is that, you know, yes, I know that this the core interest is very important, but the trade-off is mistaken. You know, while you are keeping Syrian refugees away, or while you are using this military airbase, you are losing Turkey. And Turkey is turning into a kind of problem spot.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the lack of calculation. So I can understand that Turkey is a very geopolitically important country, mm-hmm. that you can hardly find such a country maybe in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The keeping Turkey as a democracy is also an important strategic interest,
mm-hmm.
not only for Turkish people, for all its friends in the West.
You're describing it as a miscalculation. It seems
this is
like
what I think, yeah.
How much?
And I know I saw the result, and now people see the result. You know,
yeah.
Turkey getting closer and closer to Putin's orbit,
right?
And Turkey is buying Russian missiles,
right? Turkey, a NATO ally is quite extraordinary.
And you know, the in Syria, the Kurds were the partner of the international community against ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
And Erdogan started to attack those Kurds. So, and it got the encouragement from Russia. And now Turkey is buying the nuclear systems from Russia. So you see, I mean, while you are thinking that you protect your short-sighted interests,
mm-hmm.
like the military base and the refugees, you are losing Turkey.
Well, it makes you wonder what Turkey would have to do in order to cross a line in the eyes of American leadership, European leadership. Like you said, if they went back 5 years and they just got a glimpse at where we are today, you would think that this would have crossed a major line, that they would have never allowed it to get to this point had they seen it in one view. But it was incremental. It was one step at a time, and here we are.
Yeah. So I indeed talked to an important policymaker who was a very important person in Obama administration. I said that you made a great mistake. He said, what is the mistake? I said, you had a good decision to support Erdogan when he was doing good things in terms of democratization, in terms of reforms, etc. And that made Turkey great. But when Turkey made the U-turn, when Erdogan made the U-turn, you are not able to understand it first. And then you are not able to react to it timely. Now we are paying, you are paying the price, and Turkish people are paying the price. You could do something, you know, candidly. And Obama had perfect relations with Erdogan. He could use that impact, that influence for positive, you know. He could tell that this is friend, we are friends, we are brothers. So most of the years that Obama was in power and Erdogan was destroying the media and the democracy in Turkey, Obama kept silent. He said no word publicly. But, you know, when you don't treat some problem when it is when in the beginning,
yeah,
it becomes harder to solve it when it becomes late, you know. That is where we are. So I don't know what to suggest, but still, I mean, Turkish people, a lot of Turkish people are aspiring to have to be a real democracy. They are struggling. And some international, especially the Europeans, could do more, because the America's image is not that positive in Turkey or in the Middle East.
Right.
Even if America does something against Erdogan, it will benefit Erdogan.
Looking at just within the region, you're talking about, it is quite extraordinary to see this nation that was such a strong component, important component of NATO, and even the alliance with Israel. I think for a long time, Turkey's support of Israel was a major bulwark to Israeli security in a hostile neighborhood. For that to turn to really strongly anti-Israel, anti-American government, how much does that change Turkey's relations with the nations in the region? You look at Iran trying to extend its dominance of the region and you know, its influence through proxies all over the region, and Saudi Arabia, these two nations that are kind of battling for somewhat of supremacy within that area. Where does Turkey fit into that calculus, just as far as the Middle East, North Africa, Southern Europe?
So in my view, Turkey is an unpredictable country now. So in the past, it was very predictable. I mean, you could guess in what situation Turkey would do what. But now you can't know it, because the state structure is not producing the policies. The one man is producing the policies. So all people are looking what the man will say. So it's very unpredictable. You know, you could say that as I described the relations with Russia, you know, it was very bad, and it turned to be very good by just reaction of one person. So the state bureaucracy is not involved. And it is also the case in Syria, for instance. We saw that. In Syria, just 1 week before this chemical attack to a region, you know, in Syria, Erdogan hosted the Russian and Iranian presidents. They gave a very important picture, as if Turkey is part of a new alliance. And strangely, Turkey is against Assad. Erdogan is against Assad for since 2012. And these two countries are inside with Assad. Can you imagine?
Syria is quite a soup right now.
Can you imagine the craziness? But, you know, that was strange to, I mean, you are getting a kind of alliance with your alliances of your enemy. That was, ridiculous. But just 1 week after, when there has been this the chemical attack, the Turkish government was asking U.S., you know, the Trump had ordered some bombing. It was appreciating that effect, you know, that you should bomb Assad, etc. So, I mean, it's very difficult to understand what is the bases, what is the borderline of Turkish foreign policy in the region.
Yeah.
So it's not predictable. But, I mean, what I could say, you know, when Turkey was trying to develop itself as a successful democracy, as a successful economy, having good relations with all the neighbors, having good relations with the Muslims in the Middle East and the West, it had a very, very positive role to contribute even to the conflict between Israel and Palestine.
Hmm.
Because both sides were trusting Turkey. And Turkey was not seen as a kind of imperialistic player. But now with those kind of tactics or the actions that Erdogan is doing, the Arab countries are afraid of Turkey's intentions. They are questioning. The Egypt is not happy with the position of Turkey. The Syria, of course, is they are a kind of inimical relationship. Saudis are not happy with Turkey's involvement. So the 1 week Turkey is getting good with Qatar, with the other week it gets well with Iran. So I mean, this is very difficult to understand. And Turkey, in my view, declined its power to facilitate the problems, solving the problems in the Middle East. It could be, it could have that potential, but if it could go in the direction of being a democratic country focused not on being an empire, but being a strong nation state, you know, respecting all other countries around itself, around its borders. Now many people, and Erdogan is making domestically use of this Ottomanism, you know, neo-Ottomanist ideology. So when you look at the Turkish TVs, you could see a lot of TV serials. So most people learn things not through news, but through those TV serials. And on these TV serials are making the propaganda of the romanticism of reviving Ottoman Empire. So that's not helpful. That's not healthy. You know, you can have respect to Ottoman past, but you cannot revive it, you know. Out of Ottoman Empire, we have more than 25 states, and they are all nation states, you know. The Egypt is one of them. Palestine is one of them. The Albania is one of them. So, I mean, this is romantic. And it's not realistic, you know. With this romanticism, Turkey entered into Syrian struggle. Erdogan was thinking that they could change the regime in Syria and they could establish a pro-Turkish, pro-Turkey, Ikhwan-type, Muslim Brotherhood-type regime. So we realize, and we should have been learning, that this is beyond our capacity.
You talked about the divisions within Turkey and the pro-Erdogan forces and the anti-Erdogan forces and the divisions within those. And you were talking about how that has kind of enabled this authoritarian government in some ways. Right now, there is a lot of division within the United States. And I just wonder if you look at that and you see if there's anything what is happening in Turkey that kind of could serve as a warning to us in the United States.
Yeah, many things. You know, this continuous attack against media recently is not a good sign. Whether you are attacking to Fox or you are attacking CNN, it doesn't matter. I'm looking at the issue as a bipartisan person. So, I mean, as I said, the protecting freedom of media is very vital for protecting democracy. So it's not possible to have a controlled media and democracy together. So it's a fixed menu. that you can't have a democracy without freedom of media. And the media, you may have problems. I have also lots of concerns and problems, but they could fix it in itself. And you could talk about those things. I mean, the fabricated news, fake news, all other issues, biases, stereotypes. We should talk those things as citizens, irrespective of our political ideologies, you know. And of course, what I think is, you know, we may have different opinions about healthcare or North Korea, how to deal with it, or tax system, whatever. We can have differences on those things, but we should not have differences on the common basic principles of democracy. And the freedom of press is one of them. So we should not forget about that. And of course, the second thing is independence of judiciary. So if a judge tomorrow decides not in line with the rule of law, but in line with the party leader that he sympathizes, it's an important alarm that his democracy is under attack. So this is not good. I talk irrespective of this judge attitude, whether liberal, whether conservative, whatever. So the third thing is the polarization. You know, what I see a very negative sign in this society is a huge level of polarization, which is not helpful. So I advise with my humble capacity to people, to Americans, that, I mean, continue talking to people who you don't agree with. I mean, you can debate about those things, but don't hate from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Don't cut the communication. Don't cut the dialogue. But now I see that there's a lack of dialogue among many people. So they started to see each other as if they are the citizens of different countries, which is not promising, which is not good. That doesn't help society.
Well, okay. Thank you so much for your time.
You.
It's been great to talk with you.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
The rivalry between Patriarch Isaac's twin boys, Jacob and Esau, is one of the Bible's most intriguing dramas. Even before their birth, God prophesied of them to Rebekah, "Two nations are in your womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from your bowels, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger." Bible history then shows how younger brother Jacob swindled Esau out of his birthright and his blessing. Genesis 27 records, "And Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, 'The days of mourning for my father are at hand. Then will I slay my brother Jacob.'" As remarkable as it may sound, whole nations descended from these brothers, and the bitter grudge of the elder remains to this day and will play out crucially in end-time events, according to Bible prophecy. Jacob fathered the 12 tribes of ancient Israel, which Herbert W. Armstrong in the United States and Britain in Prophecy proved to be, among other nations, Britain, America, and Israel. Likewise, Esau's descendants comprise the nation of Turkey today. Understanding this opens up the understanding of biblical prophecy, an invaluable guide to world events, including events to watch for in Turkey. In prophecy, Esau, or Edom, is referred to several times. One of the most important is a prophecy in Psalm 83 we refer to often, speaking of an alliance of nations that will come together in this end time. This is a confederation of Arab nations, including Saudi Arabia, with Germany, and very importantly, Turkey. And the prophecy reveals that it's an alliance specifically aimed at attacking the peoples of Israel. We explain this in our booklet, The King of the South. This prophecy gives us a lot to watch for in the news as we see these nations' interests aligning in various ways. that are certain to bring them together in the time ahead. Another critical prophecy is in the prophetic book of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom, or Esau, I have made you small among the heathen. You are greatly despised. These words describe modern Turkey. Interestingly, political analysts point out that Turkey doesn't have a single neighbor with whom it is on consistently good terms. This prophecy shows how Turkey will commit a shocking act of betrayal against Americans and Israelis in a concession to its allies in Europe. It's particularly interesting in light of the anti-American, anti-Israel nature of the regime now controlling Turkey. And it's also interesting considering Turkey's ongoing efforts to curry favor with Europe, even working to become a European Union member state. However, this prophecy indicates that although Turkey will remain committed to its romance with Europe, its efforts are doomed to fail. One major issue stands in the way. Religion. The fundamentally Roman Catholic continent simply has no intention of incorporating 80 million Muslims in one swoop. And Turkey, with its Ottoman history, which at one time threatened Catholicism's very existence, has particularly negative associations in European minds. As Bernard Lewis expressed it, there is still a reserve of mistrust and even at times of hostility toward Turks with roots deep in the European Christian past. Turkey's openly Islamic president has solidified Europe's unspoken yet inflexible resistance to embracing Turkey. Still, given this nation's growing strategic value to Europe, watch for the EU to continue to dangle carrots and incentives to keep the Turks on side. The biblical prophecies regarding events in the Middle East are clear. A Muslim-Jewish war is about to erupt, initiated by Islamic forces. That conflagration will trigger a series of events leading to the second coming of Jesus Christ. When the Muslims move to sack Jerusalem, it will provoke a united European bloc of nations to intervene. This bloc will set up armies around Jerusalem, appearing like a peacekeeping force, but quickly transforming into a deadly war machine. You can read that in Luke 21 and verse 20. It won't be just Arabs or Muslims that suffer at their hands. This European power will turn its full force on the modern nations of Israel, which include America and Britain. Many in the Jerusalem area will be trapped. Obadiah's prophecy shows how Turkey, possessing the escape route via land, the Cilician Gates Mountain Pass, will actually betray those Israelis, Americans, and British who are trying to escape, delivering them into the hands of their European conquerors. The description in the Bible of these events reveals several things that illuminate the meaning of present-day headlines. One, the fact that those escapees look to Turkey strongly indicates that Turkey's alliances with the U.S. and with Israel will remain, at least in name. Two, the betrayal may mean we can expect still more friction to develop within these alliances. Though the U.S. still enjoys Turkey's support in some ways, anti-Americanism is rampant and growing, a fact that the U.S., as desperate as it is to retain Turkey's help, is willing to overlook. Three, for Turkey, relations with Europe will continue to trump other foreign policy considerations. Thus, based on biblical prophecy, in the end, the trumpet expects events to cement this nation's unique position in modern geopolitics. They may tax Turkey's agreements with the U.S. and Israel, but won't destroy them. They may increase Turkey's cooperation with Muslim states, but that cooperation will fall short of a full-scale alliance. And most importantly, they will strengthen Europe's resolve to keep Turkey at arm's length, but do nothing to diminish Turkey's resolve to ally with Europe. And as Obadiah's prophecy reveals, that nation's willingness to do anything to serve this ambition, including betrayal, will lead to its ruin. Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much to my guest, Abdulhamid Balichi. Thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Thomas Jefferson. Experience hath shown that even under the best forms of government, those entrusted with power have, in time and by slow operations, perverted it into tyranny. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.